Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at pem.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last time you stubbed your toe on your child's school backpack, you were probably shocked at how heavy all those textbooks were. Those big tomes, biology, math, social studies, and the rest have been around a while, unavoidable since you grew up and maybe before. Do they still make sense in the tablet computer era? Apple says no, so do others. It's time for iPads and Kindles to give old-fashioned textbooks the boot, they say. This hour on Point, the revolution in your child's backpack, e-textbooks, and what happens when education goes digital. You can join the conversation. Is your school doing away with paper and ink textbooks yet? Thinking about it, do you like the idea, and where do digital textbooks take us, take education? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Mount Hood, Oregon, is Katie Ash, staff writer for Education Week and Education Week's tech publication, Digital Directions. She's been covering the slow move from text to tablets for several years now. Katie Ash, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
All this has been going on for a while now. There's evolution underway, but suddenly we see tablets everywhere. And then last week, Apple explicitly got into this game. Where does that stand? First of all, just on Apple, what are they proposing, Katie?
Yeah, last week they made a big announcement at the Guggenheim, and it sort of had three different parts to it, all three affecting the K-12 education market. The first was the announcement of a new app called iBooks 2, through which they're going to be distributing textbooks, and they have said that those textbooks will be about $14.99 or less. And they're partnering with some of the three major publishers of K-12 education materials, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, Pearson, and McGraw-Hill, mm-hmm. to be able to provide those. So Okay. Those are all available right now. The second part of their announcement was an iBook author app, which will allow anybody with a Mac or Mac product to be able to create their own textbooks. And I should say, these are not just sort of digital versions of print textbooks. They're actually, making use of the technology that they're on with interactive, elements, mm-hmm. charts, videos, molecular models, 3D molecular models you can spin around with your fingers, zoom in on, all of those kinds of things. And mm-hmm. that's available for both the iBook 2 books that are already out and pre-written, pre-published, but also in the iBook author app, you can add
them. So make your own, dear exactly. teacher, dear professor, dear school, okay?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then the third part was this iTunes U announcement, which is...
U as in university, sort of.
U as in university, yes. And it has been focused more on the higher education piece of it than the K-12 in the past. And it seems like that's still the case. It's basically made the functionality more so that teachers can distribute full-length courses through iTunes U. They had a few launched from Duke, Yale, and Stanford, I haven't seen anything in the K-12 level yet. So those were the big three announcements that they had last week.
And, of course, they're not the only ones who are pushing into this field, pushing onto tablet computers. Katie, a lot of questions then. I guess the first one is, so you're saying that the biggest textbook publishers in the country are saying, yeah, we're ready, here you go. Our textbooks can flow right onto your tablet and off they go. They're ready to play in this game?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, this is really the first time that we've seen these big players all kind of come together and stand behind a new platform. And they've been getting into digital textbooks for a while now, really. I know Houghton Mifflin Harcourt has established their own app called the HMH Fuse that is an Algebra 1 textbook with a lot of the same functionalities that the iBooks seem like they yep. have as well. Mm-hmm. So this is not their first foray into it, but it is sort of the first organized kind of way that they're getting into it.
$14.99 maybe for a textbook that goes on to an iPad, let's say. Now, how does that compare? And I know this is much more complicated, but just how does that compare with the cost of a paper and ink old-fashioned textbook generally?
Yeah, you know, people are saying the price point for that is about $100 a pop. Like you said, that's a lot more complicated, so we'll just go with that for now.
Okay.
Really,
but of course, that book
vary.
Probably gets reused and reused.
Absolutely.
By many different students. The $14.99, is that for each student?
That's for each student, yes, as far as I can tell. And that's one of the major concerns, I think, with this announcement, is the fact that, you know, with this model, it will be just one textbook for one student, which sort of means that each student needs an iPad as well, which is not the place where most schools are today to be able to provide that for their students.
Well, let's look at the cost of that. I mean, $14.99 doesn't sound too expensive until you think about how it adds up over years, but iPads cost, what, at least like $500 these days?
Yeah, about $500 for a new one. I think you can get the first version for $400, but still that price point is way above what schools are typically being able to spend at this point. So it's a major concern in terms of who's actually going to be able to use these textbooks. Is this really something that's going to be able to be adopted? And right now, educators are saying, no, not really. You know, a lot of schools have iPads, but they may be on a cart that's shared with lots of different classrooms, not necessarily a one-to-one ratio of, you know, iPad to student.
Right. We're hearing about teachers these days maybe pushing around a grocery cart full of iPads that they distribute, the students use them, they collect them, take them to the next class, but this is based on the idea, ultimately, of every student having an iPad. Mm-hmm. Let's come back to that just for a second. Is there some way in which that adds up? Where would that come from? I mean, there's so many students in this country.
Absolutely.
Times $500 per student.
Absolutely,
Is there any way that fits into America's education budget?
You know, it's kind of hard to say at this point. I would say right now for all of the schools to be able to go out there and buy one for every student, no, that's not likely to happen. Apple has said that there are about 1.5 million iPads in education right now. I'm curious about that number in terms of whether that refers to public schools in particular or that's public and private, public, private, and homeschoolers. What exactly does that number refer to? And so, you know, a lot of schools don't have this. And a lot of schools in some cases don't even have the infrastructure to be able to support iPads. If somebody gave them an iPad for every student, their networks wouldn't be able to support it. And so there's a long systemic problem here that needs to be addressed before we can even think about moving in this direction.
Well, for that matter, all the schools that don't have Apple products, they have computers, but they're not Apple computers.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I should say all of the apps that were released are only available for Apple products on Macs. And the books themselves are only available on the iPad.
And yet, it feels like the future. It feels, you know, the big old textbooks seem kind of like yesterday's.
Absolutely.
Stack of wood. And mm-hmm. And this vision is enticing. Katie Ash with Education Week, please stand by there in Oregon. I want to welcome into our conversation from St. Paul, Minnesota, John Bailey. He's director of Whiteboard Advisors. It's an education consulting group, works with schools and philanthropies, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, state and local governments. He worked in the Bush administration, director of education technology at the U.S. Department of Education there. John Bailey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
First question, I guess, then, off of what Katie's just told us, is this just a giant recipe for a digital divide here? What percentage of American students could conceivably, or schools, could conceivably afford to put an iPad, for example, in the hands of every student?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's two ways to think about that. I mean, first of all, I know even today we're talking specifically about the iPad and the iBook announcement from last week. You really have to kind of look at this whole sector, that there is just an explosion of tablet devices coming out from Microsoft, running Microsoft operating systems, Google operating systems, as well as the iPad. I was out at the Consumer Electronics Show 2 weeks ago. 37 football fields of consumer electronics from televisions, and there were just tablets everywhere in every single form factor and every single price point that you could sort of think of. So I think we can think about this as having a really rich competition with lots of high-priced tablets, you know, everything from the $500 iPad down to sort of lower-cost $200, $100 devices. The second thing is I think you have to think about these as not just purely the investment that's being made in the tablet, that it's the applications that go on top of it too. So a lot of schools right now will easily spend $100 for a student to get a scientific graphing calculator.
Okay.
And when you have an iPad, you know, that's comes part of it as part of a free app. So all of a sudden the cost of these things start coming down over time, especially if school districts start thinking creatively about how to use some of their existing budget, rebudget that for the type of resources that they can get on a tablet.
Now,
iPad,
you may be right, though I remember very clearly shelling out myself for those, you know, the graphing calculators for my kids. So, but just to be clear, we're going to look at many aspects of this, but do you see the possibility of mass adoption of tablet computer textbooks in this country? Mass adoption, John, or is this
absolutely.
For rich kids and rich communities?
No, I don't think it's just for rich kids. I think this is inevitable. It's just a matter of the pace. I mean, I think you saw over the holiday weekend, the Christmas holiday, Pew just came out with research that said the number of ebook, both readers as well as the number of ebooks purchased doubled. I think you see, again, all these explosion of tablet devices across the price spectrum. And I think you're seeing, and again, in the middle of a recession, one of the worst recessions in American history, you've had this huge adoption of very expensive devices, but some really rich in scientific, really rich innovation going on as well. And I think, again, it all comes down to how schools think about their budgets. And as they start to repurpose budgets that were used to purchase physical books, physical resources, physical instructional materials, and move that over to digital, they'll be able to find ways to help afford this.
Is it just gee whiz and a lighter backpack, or is it the ground for a better education?
Yeah, I think that's the big question. And in some ways, this has been the trick that has sort of followed technology for quite some time, which is it can be a huge distractor or it can be something that can really help engage students, complement teaching, and expand the universe. And so I think it's the way that it's used in the classroom, and that's going to come back down to how that teacher really wants the iPad and the iBooks to be used.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the revolution in your child's backpack, tablet computers, looking to replace all those big old textbooks. And what happens with education when textbooks go digital? Katie Ash is with us from Education Week from Mount Hood, Oregon. From St. Paul, Minnesota, John Bailey is here, director of Whiteboard Advisors, an education consulting group there. Funny response online. I was talking about a 20-pound backpack here, Katie, John, for kids that they'd be able to throw down. Neil says, 20 pounds? He says, my son's backpack is closer to 40 pounds. Anna Christina says, chiropractors everywhere will lament this change. Okay, it'll be lighter. But Katie, what are they putting into these textbooks if and when, I mean, it's happening now, so when they go into a tablet computer, is it just pouring the text in there? Is that like a basic offering? Is everything whirling and twirling and, you know, interactive? Katie, what's the range of what happens to textbooks when they go digital?
Yeah, you know, it does range quite a bit, and we've seen everything from the print textbook being transformed into a PDF, and that's kind of it. These textbooks seem to be actually attempting to make use of the sort of technology that they're on, like you said, whirling and twirling, diagrams and models, things like that, interactive elements, videos, images. I think you can even put keynote presentations into your textbooks through the iBook Author app. So they are, you know, more technologically advanced than we've seen on the print version. I know some other textbooks, I don't know about specifically Apple, but include links to maybe current events in the history textbook or, you know, other sort of interactive, internet-enabled kinds of elements that can also sort of enhance learning and sort of tie it into the real world and those kinds of things.
John Bailey, do they begin to move in on what we traditionally thought of as the teacher's role or part of it here? I mean, the textbook laid out a whole lot of information. It was the teacher that put together the exercises and quizzes and did the assessment. I mean, do these textbooks have exams built right into them? Do they correct the exams? Do they assess the exam performance and all that kind of thing? Or is that a different thing, John?
You know, I think what's going to happen here is that it's going to change the role for the teacher. That there's been this notion that's kind of emerged out of the last couple of years of something called the flipped classroom. That if you think about a traditional classroom today, Students go into it, and it's mostly a lecture with a little bit of conversation and interactivity. And when you have these interactive textbooks that can embed videos and lectures as well as some other interactive modules, it means that students, for homework, can literally go through the lectures, go through some of the information gathering, and then that time in the classroom can be better spent on more interactive conversation, discussion, more one-on-one time with teachers. So I think in some ways it's going to help change the role of teaching in a way that probably teachers will like even more, because it empowers them and it gives them a chance to do more one-on-one instruction with the kids.
And we've got Chantel, who writes on our website here that she thinks it's fantastic, you know, it can stay current, and you have interactive problem solving. And Katie, you're saying that's happening. Do they update these things automatically? Do I have to pay another, I don't know, $2.99 for an updated version halfway through the year?
Well, hopefully not. No, a lot of them are built in already. You know, sometimes they'll have math problems, and you can click on the math problem, and it'll show you step-by-step how to do it. They'll have interactive quizzes, like you were saying, at the end of each chapter. Those kinds of things are already built in. So it really does change what a textbook can do and what role that's playing for the student and for the teacher.
Here the Levi writes, the real effect is going to be on the teaching profession. Levi writes, they're the ones who need to watch their back. John, you say this may actually make their life better.
Yeah, again, because it's just changing the role of the teacher. That traditionally, teacher had to stand up before a class of 20 or 30 kids and help communicate an entire sort of group worth of material in a way that all those kids could sort of grasp it. It was very difficult for them to personalize it to those kids, very difficult for them. They had to teach to the middle of the class. And now in this sort of flipped classroom environment, you have these ebooks where, you know, students that learn better by reading can read. The students that need a little bit more assistance can click on a video, maybe get another lecture from the Khan Academy on some sort of complicated math concept. Students that needed to struggle a little bit more could play with some simulations. So there's a way of helping students master some of this content in lectures outside of the class so that the time in the class can be used for what we know from research to be the most valuable aspect of teaching and learning, and that's the engagement between students and students and students and teachers.
So all kinds of adaptation that can take place here. Purnima writes online, my daughter is visually impaired. As far as our family is concerned, these textbooks can't get here fast enough. I guess you could bump up the font size as needed. Let's get to our callers. Cookeville, Tennessee. Robert's calling. Hi, Robert. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would just like to make a point that I would like to argue that a sturdy textbook is going to be infinitely more durable than one of these flimsy devices. Little Johnny's going to spill his milk on, if he spills his milk on a book, well, we just wipe it up, pretty much takes care of the problem. What happens when one of these kids, drops one of these tablets down the stairs at school? What happens when they're in the classroom and the battery dies?
Or tries to play Frisbee with it in the playground.
Absolutely. I'd just like to make that point to your panel, and I'll take my... I'll take their comments off air. Thanks.
Thank you, Robert. Well, they're not cheap, so it matters. John Bailey, what about it? The textbook is infinitely more durable, sturdy than a tablet computer.
Yeah, it's a great point, because these are, you know, sophisticated technology devices, and you need some sort of protection with covers, and kids are kids. They're going to drop things. Maybe they'll use them for Frisbees. I doubt they'll use them for Frisbees. But I do think there's a challenge, too, with the traditional textbook format, which is you have students each year who get a textbook and find that pages have been ripped out, chapters that are missing. And so, you know, it's not that one is more durable than the other. They both have sort of strengths and weaknesses, and schools are going to have to sort of manage that. I don't think this is going to be sort of an all or nothing proposition either. I think you're going to find that a lot of schools, just like you and I, that some of us read books on our iPads and on our tablets and on our Kindle readers, but we still, you know, read the newspaper in a traditional format. I think we're going to find schools doing the same thing, that there's going to be some traditional resources kids interact with in a physical format and others that they interact with in a digital format.
A couple of listeners on Facebook here. Debbie says, what about the problem of distractions? Once you're online or digital, you're maybe online and then off you go. Tim writes, got a background in engineering. As an engineering graduate student and professor, he said he saw how complicated the lesson became by textbooks that took on a comic book quality, overdone with color and illustrations. I mean, Katie, what about that? Once you get digital, people can go sort of overboard with the jazzy stuff, and it may be dazzling looking when it's time to sell it at a big book fair or the Consumer Electronics Show. But what about distraction if it's digital, Katie?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that definitely is a concern, and that's something that, as technology has proliferated, the education, K-12 education, we've heard a lot of those concerns. A lot of people have sort of recognized that technology can be, you really have to make sure that it's implemented in your classroom in a thoughtful way, and that technology is a tool, and you shouldn't be doing something with it unless there is a real educational purpose behind it, like the commentary mm-hmm. mentioned, having something into a comic book style that may not necessarily enhance the educational value might be cool looking, but might not be the best use of your time or your students' time. And so being really thoughtful about making those choices, having the teacher be really thoughtful about making those choices about what they bring into their classroom and how it's used, and keeping in mind that technology is a tool to help students learn, I think is really fundamental for teachers to understand and to help keep those distractions down. And of course, there are going to be some distractions, just like there always have been in school with kids passing notes, trying to talk to their friends, that kind of stuff. It's just in a different format at this point. It's instead of writing a handwritten note, it might be a text message, things like that.
But will they be off? I mean, the teacher may not know. I've got teachers writing here. They don't know whether their kids are, doing their homework or off somewhere on the internet. They have no idea. Are there fences in here, Katie, or is it wide open?
Well, in some cases, I think that it is a classroom management issue for teachers to be able to figure out whether their students are on task or not. I've had some teachers tell me that if students are really engaged in what they're doing, they're not going to be distracted. They're not going to be surfing the net. Of course, you're going to have those issues with students potentially, spacing out, surfing the net, doing something they're not supposed to be doing. There are ways for teachers to manage that, and that's partly why teachers need a lot of professional development to be able to really, effectively implement these kinds of tools in their classroom, which they haven't used before with students. And so having that training to know how to deal with some of those issues is really important to the success of these kinds of projects and programs.
John Bailey, a lot of listeners are asking about the content of e-textbooks and how it could be changed. Now, we know over time some big states, California, Texas in particular, have had a lot to do with what ends up in our textbooks because they sign off on it there. They're very large states, big populations, and so sometimes, for example, Texas may put a conservative imprint on textbooks that end up getting sold nationally. Presumably with e-textbooks, they could be tailored and tailored and tailored. I mean, I've got one listener, Terry, says, textbook will be able to have their own warped textbooks. Texas, he says, will. But Oldman says it could make, maybe with a wink and a grin here, it could make some things easier. Things like unwanted historical facts or concepts like evolution could be eliminated from all textbooks. How much adaptability will there be in these? And how much, political editing may come into the e-realm here, John?
I think this is another sort of huge issue that's really, it's not just an ebook issue. This is really a publishing issue that you have 21 states, including some of the very large, powerful states of California, Texas, and Florida, that have some sort of committee or process to decide which books can be used in public schools. And so I think even in this ebook realm, you're going to have a lot of these committees deciding what is allowed and not to be allowed for those public dollar uses in those particular states. But I do think it gets us out. It does address the problem in two different ways. One, it gets us a whole new universe of potential publishers. One of the things we haven't really talked a lot about on the show is something that Katie mentioned, which is this new tool that lets anyone become their a book publisher and gives them an entire platform in which to publish those books. And so, not only with the big publishers, but now you have a whole new potential set of homegrown publishers, from teachers to other experts that can publish materials or just little compilations.
Is that good or is that weird? I mean, you could have some very iconoclastic versions of history or science or anything you can imagine.
Well, and I think that's part of the reason you have these committees is to help make sure that, some of the weird or not, traditional stuff isn't necessarily allowed in schools or in the classroom. And even if you didn't have these committees, you'd still have some sort of process. Even if it was down to the school district level or the principal or the teachers, there'd be some sort of curated area where teachers would say, okay, this is the material that we're going to go with. But when you think about what a textbook is, in the end, it's just a compilation of nuggets of text about a particular subject with maybe see a couple different graphics and charts and whatnot. The ebooks are just sort of expanding on that, allowing those compilations to be kind of reassembled in different ways depending on state needs, mm-hmm. and also allowing for other objects, multimedia objects, interactive objects as well, some video and some audio as well. So it's going to, I think, you know, the challenge that we have here is we still have this very 19th century regulatory system in a mm-hmm. lot of the states trying to figure out what to do with this 21st century revolution here. And we're not going to be able to sort of make that square peg fit in that round hole unless public policy sort of catches up to
it. Well, there will be some growing and changing pains. John Bailey, Katie Ash, stand by. Joining us right now from Lincolnshire, Illinois, is Charlene Chaussis. She's Manager for Technology Training and Integration at the Adlai E. Stevenson High School in Lincolnshire. Charlene, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Let's talk about teachers first. Are they eager to get tablets in the classroom? Are you doing that yet? And are teachers gung-ho or resistant?
We have a bunch of teachers that are gung-ho. We started a pilot last year bringing in the iPads on carts, as we were talking earlier about that. Mm-hmm. And my job was the professional development, the thing that we were talking how important it is to have the professional development and talk about the teaching practice and actually creating materials. So I have 150 teachers that now have iPads and that are doing lessons with iPads in the classroom with our students, and they'll bring a cart in of 30 iPads and go through a couple of days with a lesson that they've created, that they've put together using a combination of text that they're creating their own EPUB files for that lesson, and combining that with different apps that will help the students learn the content because of the interaction with the device itself.
But they're expensive. You're carting them around the school in carts, as you say, not sending one home with each student. So far at Adlai Stevenson, the interaction with the tablet is just in the classroom, Charlene?
Right now, we're looking at pilots for next year that's going to go to the one-to-one environment where students will have them 24/7, because what we're finding out is that the iPad is a personalized device, and to use that in a classroom setting, you know, there's extra time that the teacher has to take to be sure that the students prepare the iPad for the next class and making sure that they close out their apps or delete the files that they've left behind. So there's a...
Sure. If it's a tablet for each student, if I may ask, Charlene Chaussis, who pays? Who pays for that tablet?
We haven't figured out the model yet. As far as schools that I've seen around here that do a one-to-one initiative in Illinois, that becomes part of your school fee. So the money that you would normally put into your textbooks or the school fees that you have will be aggregated over the 4 years, and that would pay for the device. So the students ideally would keep the device for 4 years, and that should take them through their entire experience, at least at a high school level.
And what if they lose it or drop it off the back of the bleachers on the you know, gymnasium floor? Who pays for the replacement?
Well, there's insurance plans available for things like that, just as if you were doing the same type of one-to-one initiative with any tablet device or any laptop device. You know, there are plans that you can get that will cover loss and cover destruction and cover accidental things that could happen, you know, just with regular use besides.
Well, look at the details. It's really interesting since you're on the front line of this. But overall, are you popular with students and teachers in your school with your cart of iPads or not? I mean, are they welcoming this overall or not sure? What's your sense of the response you're getting, Charlene?
Both the teachers and the students are very welcoming of the devices. They enjoy learning with them. We're seeing academic gains. We're doing surveys amongst the students saying, you know, do you think this lesson was better learned because of the technology that was implemented, or is it something that we should go back and learn it the old way? I mean, both of the teachers and the students are finding great ways to learn with the devices. So it's very positive right now.
And what about the danger of getting lost in the sort of razzle-dazzle that can be on the digital screen?
I don't think we're getting lost at all. I think that's the part about the pedagogy in the classroom and what the teachers are doing to monitor and work with the students. It's we know that if we're going to hand out these devices to the students and say this is the lesson today, we're not just going to sit up in the front of the room and grade papers. You know, we're going to walk around and work with individual students. But that's the great piece, is that because each student can personalize their learning, I can work with a group of students in one part of the room knowing that the other part of the room is on task, and I can move around and see where each person is at that level and help them along the way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what happens with education when textbooks go digital. It is happening. Apple making a big push last week. A lot of publishers saying, all right, we're in already. Schools looking to see if they can replace paper and ink books with digital offerings that can offer a lot more. But there's a big conversation also on board about exactly how that's going to work. This is the revolution in your child's backpack. Maybe it won't weigh 40 pounds anymore. Kitty Ash is with us from Education Week. John Bailey from Whiteboard Advisors, an education consulting group out of St. Paul, Minnesota. Charlene Chausses is with us from the Adlai Stevenson High School in Lincolnshire, Illinois. She's manager for technology training and integration there. And a lot of listener response here. Thomas says on Facebook that at his high school in Knoxville, Tennessee, they've got a policy of one iPad per student from fifth grade to through the end of high school. They're giving parents there the option of payment plans or renting to stretch it out. Josh says, yeah, it's expensive, but look at the long-term benefits if we can provide a better education. Jennifer, not so sure. She says, goodbye, nature. Adios, fellow humans. Hello, screens. And then there is this concern I want to ask the panel and more about poorer school districts. Solly says, I'm curious to hear how it's going to apply where there's less money. Lane, the kind of suggesting we don't romanticize that. Lane says, working at lower income schools, the books there are old, beat up, and many are missing pages. So textbooks are not always perfect either. Let's go to our listeners. Jim in Concord, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I'm finding this topic to be fascinating. I actually been involved in electronic publishing for a long time. I was with a major publishing company back in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And when PCs started coming out, we decided to launch a systems group, which was focused on electronic publishing. But that was in the days of a few computers, $4,000 prices, green screens,
sure,
very slow, of course, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, here we, you know, jumping forward, you know, almost 30 years, you know, I've got my own kids. They're constantly on their computers. They're now, two of my three have got Kindles recently. They're engaged so much electronically along with also having their books. But, you know, in the day of, you know, Wikipedia and so many online sources, I'm curious how you see the role of the publishing company. Is this a tool for them to sort of reinforce their position, to sort of stave off the used book crisis, which bites into their profits? Or is it sort of the beginning of the end for them, where it will become open source textbooks?
Open source. And let me ask you, while I've got you, Jim, you've been in this business a long time, thinking about it a long time. You've got kids. Would you dump the books and have them go all tablet, or would you be nervous about that?
Well, you know, it's an interesting point because we actually, a few years ago, looked at a school here in Massachusetts called Cushing Academy that did dump their textbooks. They closed their library and went pure digital.
Yeah.
And at the time, we had actually made the decision that we weren't going to send our son there. But it would have freaked us out at that point had they killed the books at that point. And we did not want our son to be part of that step.
And now?
But today, I think it may be a little bit different because, you know, the iPads come along, the quality of the engagement, I think, is much better. And actually, literally, we had our son, who's a football player, but we actually had him at the doctor on Friday because he was having pain in his side that they diagnosed as being due to carrying too heavy a backpack.
Oh, boy. Well, there's one very simple argument right there. Jim, I appreciate your call. Katie Ash, let me come first to you on Jim's question about publishers. I mean, people have had complaints and praise for textbook publishers for years. It's always been kind of a controversial thing, but it's been big business. One thing was, at least there was some organization or institution responsible for what was in that textbook, Katie. You could trace it back. Jim says, and it's obvious, I guess, but if you've got, here's Apple saying, hey, make your own textbooks. It's kind of an open source textbook. Mm-hmm. What about, first of all, publishers? Can they stick around? Will we still have them? Somebody taking responsibility for the integrity of these textbooks, Katie? And what about quality control if they're not there?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a huge concern. And, you know, we've seen some open source textbooks come up. You know, California a few years ago started the Free Digital Textbook Initiative there, started looking at a lot of different open source textbooks as a way to save money in that state, which is very cash strapped, especially for their schools. So, you know, schools have been looking at it, but there is that issue of quality. And from what I've heard from educators who have had both ways,
place. It is, you know, open source materials. There are lots of resources out there. There's some great content. It does take a lot more time on the part of the teacher, on the part of the administrators to curate some of that content to make sure that it's quality content, that it's accurate, and those kinds of things. And that can be, you know, time is not something a lot of teachers have a lot of. So that's a real challenge for some. When you go, you know, in the textbook publishers, you look at them and what they say, and they're trying to stay as relevant as possible as well. And that's part of, mm-hmm. you know, their argument for why textbooks play such an essential role in the classroom is that all that content obviously is vetted. It's gone over by experts.
Right.
It's weaved together in a way that is intended to, you know, really help students learn. There's, you know, some, there may be in a math book, for instance, there may be talk of concepts, you know, beforehand, and then the concept will be introduced, and then there will be follow-up in the following chapters, things like that, that it's really sequenced, and it's all right there, and it's there for the teacher to use, and that's the biggest advantage of going with, you know, a proprietary book like that that's already kind of laid out. It doesn't require much work from the teacher to be able to crack that open, or in the case of a tablet, you know, click on that app and open it up.
Yep.
They don't have to do a lot of, you know, groundwork to get that up and running.
Charlene Chaussis there in Illinois, do you, in your school, as you're promoting this, do you funnel one choice to teachers, or do you let them kind of build their own textbooks almost from scratch? Is, you know, do you end up with 16 different texts being offered to 16 different classes? How's it work, Charlene?
Well, as far as our teachers go, we are a collaborative culture here, and many of our materials that we're creating are created in teams of teachers. So if a student's taking a particular class, it's going to be a team of teachers that are going to create that lesson and put that together. So that it wouldn't be 16 different teachers making 16 different lessons. They do highly collaborate on getting this all together. But
who keeps track of the essential body of information that's in those collaborative products? Do you have, you know, do you have required data that will be in there, or can they just kind of reshape it every year?
Well, they can reshape it every year. They you know, the curriculum is depending upon what their goals are for the curriculum, and this is the best mm-hmm. way to teach what their mm-hmm. goals are. So, mm-hmm. yeah, the teams will reshape that. But they'll draw from digital text online. They'll draw from their textbooks that we have in paper here, and they'll draw from all the different resources that we have available to provide the best learning experience for their students.
Hey, John Bailey, you know, you just sort of scratch your head. It sounds very exciting in many ways, liberating for teachers. It's the opposite of kind of a straitjacket here. On the other hand, we've seen plenty of controversy in this country about what gets into textbooks. We saw, what was it, Arizona a few months ago, where they cracked down on teachers who were having a sort of a Latino-friendly versions of American history, and they didn't like that. This seems like in the e-textbook era, it could be anything goes out there, which could be great ferment, but will we have a unified body of knowledge that our students end up sharing in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of takes the debate about what should be in the curriculum and what should be the content that's presented to the students, and actually sort of pushes it down a little bit further down the chain from these sort of state committees down to the districts and down to the schools. On one hand, they have much more options, you mm-hmm. know, available to them. Some of that is open education resources. Some of that can be paid content. And there's pros and cons to both of that. Some of the free content, I've always, you know, we've talked to schools, and sometimes they talk about the free content as free like a puppy. You sort of get a free puppy, but then there's all these other expenses that come with it as you're trying to take care for it. And a lot of that is, it could be expensive in terms of teacher time, in terms of making sure that the material is right and accurate and so forth. The publishers really have to kind of reinvent themselves around not just sort of being, quote, textbook publishers, mm-hmm. but really being digital content publishers. And I think we're seeing folks do that. We're seeing companies like Scholastic sort of take what was a traditional book, disaggregate it into different content segments, and allow people, school districts, to reassemble them in the different components that they feel best meet the needs for their kids. And then you have in complete other sort of disruptors that are coming up as startups that are providing sort of new entire apps and experiences for kids that combine some social elements, some gaming elements, and some content elements as a way of helping kids master a concept. I think in the end, if you're a teacher, again, this is a great time to be a teacher, because you have a whole multitude of resources to help you reach your kids with mastering, you know, the rigorous content standards that we have for them out there.
We've got Mike in Texas writing us here online that we're overlooking college students. He says, my kids can pay $400 to $500 per semester for textbooks. That makes a tablet alternative very attractive. Joseph's calling from Boston. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know, Joseph?
Two things real quick. First one is the cost effectiveness of using the tablets. I know we've been talking about Apple, but like someone said earlier, there's really, really cheap alternatives, especially from the Android market. Some of these tablets go for $100 to $150.
Wow. Okay, so that gets down almost to a single book price there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why the change. I've recently gone back to school, and as a college student, it's amazing now that I can get all my textbooks for a fraction of the cost of what it used to be before. I used to spend around $1,000 each semester on books, especially the science ones. Now I'm able to download them for $50 to $40, and I can access it at any computer because I have it on Amazon. So I see it is a wave of the future, and it's something that we really have to push so that all kids can really experience this.
So how many textbooks do you think you've downloaded at this point, Joseph?
I have currently between 30 and 40.
Wow, so you've saved a lot of money doing that, and doing that in a college curriculum.
Amazing amount of money. Before, when I was in school 10 years ago, you literally have to take a loan out to get the textbooks. But now it's very cost-effective. On Amazon and Google, and I'm sorry, on Kindle, the search, when you're able to search and
tag,
it's an easier tool to use.
May I ask you, Joseph, on Kindle, how do you take notes? Do you take digital notes? Can you drag?
Yeah, there's an option on the left-hand side where you can actually take the notes and then pull it up at will, where you can search your notes at will. So it makes it a lot easier for you to be in class, take notes, and when you get home, to pull it up, pull those notes up.
Joseph, you really sound on top of it. I wish you luck with your college career there, and I'm glad that's working out for you. Thank you so much for that call. Let me get one more here. Debbie in Charlottesville, Virginia. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a parent of a couple of high school kids, and mm-hmm. we've been using these digital media for a couple of years now, so I just thought I'd give you some of my perspective.
Yes, please.
On the conversation.
Yeah.
We certainly went through the issue of the liability when they first our son started with netbooks in ninth grade for a program he was in.
And what do you mean liability, Debbie? Like, you mean for the don't wreck the machine?
It took 3 months before they would let these things come home.
Uh-huh.
Because of having to work through all the legal ramifications of ownership, you know, who owns them,
if you broke it, who paid for it, all that
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly.
Okay.
It is a good tool, and I'm sure that this is the wave of the future, but you can't just think of it the same way as a textbook.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the distractions that I get most concerned about.
What kind of distractions?
When my son is sitting in front of a computer screen to read his history homework or to write a paper, he also can be streaming a TV show, he can be chatting with his friends. It's all there on the same piece of equipment in front of him.
Right.
And I don't know which thing he's doing.
Right.
You know, unless I stand right over his shoulder.
Right.
It looks to me like he's doing homework.
And have they actually been distracted, or is it just a concern of yours? Has it actually played out that way?
He has. Last night even, he was facing writer's block, and he said, "Can you just come and sit in the office with me because there are just too many things that are taking my mind off of what I need to be doing."
He
recognizes it now as an 11th grader.
Yeah.
And is trying to fight against that. But I think the educators need to just remember that it's a new discipline kids are going to have to learn to block out those distractions. And I think when my kids do focus on their schoolwork, it's a different kind of way of doing schoolwork than when I was a kid, where you sat in a library, Carol, and you had a book
right.
in front of you, and you know, you could shut out the world for a while. You don't shut out the world when you're working on a tablet or a computer.
Of course, I know a lot of teenagers, Debbie, who still use paper textbooks, but they've also got a laptop open. It can be streaming anything, too. I mean, just because you're back in paper and ink territory doesn't mean there's not an electronic distraction in the world these days.
Right, right. It's not a new problem. I just think that when that's your only resource for your material.
And it's all there right on the same screen. I really appreciate your call as well, Debbie. Thanks for that. Charlene Chausses, what's your advice on this front? I mean, how do parents or teachers shield kids from losing their focus in that wonderful miasma of distraction out there in the digital realm?
Teach them where the off button is.
you know, there is a time that you have to turn it over and put it down, and we've seen that in discussions in our classrooms. You know, we'll engage the students in some activity, and when it's time now to come back to whole group discussion, okay, all iPads face down, you know, turn and talk or whatever, you can manage it in the classroom. But it is a way that our students are in this digital society. That's not going away. Every student's going to have these devices, whether they're talking about their cell phones or whatever, they are connected. And it's up to the parents, it's up to the teachers to say, you know, there is downtime and there's time for all of these technologies, but there's also time for personal one-to-one that you need to do. You need to know how to collaborate in person as well as online. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a two-edged sword.
And what about the digital divide, Charlene? You know, not every school district has the same resources. The population of every district doesn't have the same cash available. Is this going to end up, aggravating? Already you've got kids with a lot more technology than other kids. Does this push us further down that problem?
Hopefully it's going to push us towards solutions to make sure that we have equitable access for everyone in the state or everyone in the school. Illinois is struggling with that right now because most of the monies that go to schools come from property taxes. So if you're in a low area where the property values aren't very high, the school doesn't get as much money. So, you know, we're struggling with that here in Illinois.
John Bailey, does this require a fix to that old problem of resource divide, or does it just aggravate it?
I don't think it necessarily aggravates it. I think what it does is it forces a rethinking of what do you do with that budget. And, you know, again, I think actually to the point that was just made, this is a digital divide question, but it's a much, much bigger issue about quality education for our kids and making sure that, you know, we confront a 21st century education crisis, dropout crisis, not with 19th century tools, but with some of these new tools.
Well, it's all coming at us right now, and this has been a really interesting and fun introduction. John Bailey with Whiteboard Advisors in St. Paul, Minnesota. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Charlene Chaussis, we really can feel your frontline experience there, and you put it so well. Thanks for joining us from the Adlai E. Stevenson High School in Lincolnshire, Illinois. Thanks, Charlene.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Katie Ash with Education Week. You're terrific. Thanks for joining us, Katie.
Thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, thanks and good luck to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.